This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. FGCU's new Institute for Entrepreneurship is home to a statewide program for veterans, one of only six campuses participating. In its inaugural semester this year, the program graduated 35 veterans who went on to start nearly two dozen local businesses. We'll talk with the program's director and one of those veterans. But first, race, immigration, and white supremacy are some of the most frequently used terms in headlines across America in the last couple of years. And because of that and the recurring racial incidents that occurred on campus last year, FGCU is hosting a panel discussion this week on those very subjects. Race, Immigration, and White Supremacy in the Post-Obama Era is a cross-campus initiative headed by the Office of Community Outreach. J. Webb Horton is the office's assistant director and will serve as one of the discussion's moderators. He joins us now to discuss his role as moderator instead of presenter this time. Thanks for coming in.
Well, Julie, thanks for having us. This program and community outreach, which works across the five-state area or five-county area looking to work with first-generation students. But a few years ago, we instituted a lecture series, and this seemed to be a pertinent topic that we should look at given what's happened in the post-Obama era. So talking with Ted Thornhill and with Yon, this seemed to be a perfect discussion to have November 9th this coming Thursday at 5:30 in the Cohen Center.
Certainly, certainly timely. We're also joined today by sociology program leader Dr. Yon May, who will also be one of the presenters there. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And you may have seen FGCU in national headlines last week after the New York Post covered a new course being taught by assistant sociology professor Dr. Ted Thornhill. Dr. Thornhill joins the program as well to talk about his role as a presenter this week and as the professor of the class entitled White Racism. Thank you for coming in.
Oh, glad to be here. Thank you.
We are talking about race, immigration, and white supremacy in the post-Obama era, and you can join the conversation at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK on Facebook or at WGCU Public Media. And on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag of GCL. So as you mentioned, J. Webb Horton, this is the community outreach program. Is that something that originated with FGCU?
Yes. 5 years ago when I made the transition from athletics over to the academic side, Dr. Bradshaw had started the Office of Community Outreach. I felt a lecture series would be something that we should look at. We usually do two programs in the fall and two in the spring. This year, because of Irma, we lost our first program about service learning. But this issue now has really become forefront with what happened last year and some things that have happened this year. So I felt that talking to Dr. Thornhill, this would be a perfect topic. He found Yon May, who has done some pretty outstanding things relative to this topic. So I said, get the experts and let's have this discussion on this campus.
So how does a panel discussion then work? Do you have a lineup, tables in front of the room? Do you have like a circular situation, or is it something where the audience is encouraged to participate? How does that work?
Yeah, what we'll have is we'll have a table in front. Mm-hmm. We'll have the moderator, Dr. Mary DeWeese, and then Dr. Thornhill, Dr. Yon May, and then Isat Pinero and Ashton Hartley. The four of them will be at a table. We will pass out cards to people coming in where they can write their questions down. And we'll have each of the presenters make a statement, talk about their area of expertise. And then after that, we'll have a Q&A.
Oh, so there's a question and answer where the audience is invited to participate.
Yes, very
much
so. Now,
who all is invited to attend this? Anybody in the community or just FGCU people?
No, this is community-wide, county-wide, five-county area. And then obviously FGC, we encourage our students, faculty, and staff to become a part of this because this is a community and it's a campus-wide discussion.
So, okay. And then so, Dr. May, you're one of the presenters and the head of the sociology department on campus. What is your program going to be contributing to this discussion from a sociological perspective?
So I will speak just for what I'm going to cover and let Ted talk about his comments. I'm largely going to focus on the rise of the alt-right, and I'm going to highlight that this is a movement that has operated for quite some time in the United States, mostly at the fringes of political of political structure, and more recently has become more prominent. I'm going to highlight how they're sort of clouding a language of, you know, a lost country, how there's a change in our country that has been, you know, attacked from forces from the outside, but they're sort of hiding that message by using a lot of popular culture phenomena. So a lot of the people that identify with the alt-right movement may not, you know, recognize some of the racist, white supremacist, xenophobic language that, you know, somebody like Richard Spencer, who has called for, you know, the establishment of a white ethno-state.
So you're looking at it from a sociological perspective in that you're kind of identifying some of the terminology that is kind of hiding in plain sight with the alt-right?
That's correct.
What kind of things would you like – what would you point to specifically?
So a lot of the they're sort of blaming immigrants, blaming people that are not Christians, blaming to some degree also women for like changing the way that the United States ought to operate.
Mm-hmm. Do you – I don't know if we want to have an we don't want to, like, you know, ruffle any feathers as far as like whether it's real or not that things are actually changing. So what they're saying is that they're putting a blame on things, and what you're calling out is that is actually being racist.
That's correct.
Okay. So, I mean, do you find this time that we are living in right now interesting? I mean, at the very least, as a sociologist, and seeing that people are now more boldly and loudly proclaiming things of this sort?
It's certainly a fascinating time to sort of live in. I sort of hate to say that I enjoy it, because there's a lot of, you know, hatred and negativity and a lot of violence aimed at people that don't look like me, and so there's a real violence. On the other hand, it makes it very easy to sort of explain some of the phenomenon and then point to actually contemporary examples of statements that people have made. Right now, in public. And so people can't just say like, oh, that's just a thing of the past.
Yeah, well, it's definitely front and center right now. Would you say sometimes, though, that this could be a psychological issue rather than a sociological issue?
There's certainly a psychological relevance for this. But of course, I'm exploring it from a sociological point of view. And I think that's part of, you know, some of the misunderstanding. And so when we talk about racism from a sociological point of view, we focus on sort of structural discrimination. And so a lot of people say like, well, you know, can't black people, can't Hispanics be racist? And, you know, a lot of the time when we talk about those things, it's prejudice. All of us, you know, are prejudiced and so can have attitudes that are negative towards groups. But to be racist means, you know, you have to be in power and you have to be, you know, discriminating against groups for that reason. And so a lot of people say like, you know, why are we just focused on white people? And it's because of, you know, who controls different institutions.
Okay, I see what you're saying. And that makes it a perfect time now to talk to Dr. Thornhill. You're with the sociology department too, correct?
That's correct.
And so you are you're talking about the class that you have coming up. And that kind of really is – did that class start yet?
No, it starts in the spring.
It starts in the spring. So – but that is – kind of points to what he was talking about, the difference between a psychological situation and a sociological situation, which – can you explain to me, again, the difference with a psychological racism or psychological prejudice versus institutional racism?
Certainly. Most Americans – well, first of all, we're a highly individualistic society. It wouldn't be inaccurate to say we're a hyper-individualistic society. And so most people's ideas of racism are often conflated with racial prejudice. So most individuals locate racism at the ideational level with beliefs, value, attitudes, the way people think. Sociology teaches us to look at structures and institutional patterns of individual behavior and look at group differences. And so I think that people's misunderstanding about prejudice versus racism is results from the kind of confusion and the frustration and the controversy about my course in general and the panel, the language of the panel that invokes the term white supremacy.
Yeah. How did you come to determine that being the name of the course?
Well, it's the language of the literature. The course has been taught actually at the University of Connecticut for 22 years, so nearly a quarter of a century ago the course was taught. And as Dr. May mentioned, people have talked about why is the course not named Black Racism or Latino Racism or Indigenous Racism. First of all, I'm not an expert at those types of racism to the extent that they exist. I'm an expert at white racism. And like Dr. May also said, whites are in a position of power collectively. For hundreds of years, Europeans and their descendants have enacted all manner of laws, policies, practices, promoted ideologies, traditions, customs, habits, cultural aspects that serve to truncate, constrain, limit the life chances of those racialized as non-white. And so by virtue of that, we have a society where there's a racial hierarchy where whites occupy the top strata and those racialized as non-white occupy a lower strata on that kind of hierarchical continuum. And so the term white supremacy is often misunderstood by a wide swath of the American public because they think of it in terms of the neo-Nazis, skinheads, the alt-right, white nationalists, the Ku Klux Klan. And while that wouldn't be entirely inaccurate, it would be incomplete because sociologists understand white supremacy as a structural system of racial domination, somewhat analogous to patriarchy vis-a-vis gender.
So the title of this forum, this panel discussion that's happening is part of the title is the post-Obama era. Do you think that there is relevance to having just had an African-American president and what that has done towards people's view of white racism?
Yeah, I mean,
because when people would say, if you're saying that white supremacy, because the whites always have this position of power, well, mm-hmm. we did have an African-American president who had, and they will point to that and say, well, that makes everything okay.
And they do.
Yeah. And because I've heard it, and that's, I'm just repeating what people have said, and they might say to you, well, what do you mean?
Yeah.
How can you still say that? But what, can you explain to me a little bit more of the broader structure?
Sure. In any kind of structural system, there are going to be exceptions. And but it doesn't mean that they're contradictions. So you can have a black president, you can have successful Latinas or Latinos or Asian Americans, and it doesn't change the nature of the system. The system can adapt. White racism can mutate and transform, and it appears differently in different historical periods. And so Obama was treated very terribly by many of his detractors, and I don't think I need to enumerate the litany of ways in which he was racialized, for instance, as a, let's just say, a African witch doctor with a bone through his nose. And so that was individual overt racism on the part of those who connected Obama to that. But the rise of the Tea Party is a response to the first black president. I mean, the current
kind of a reactionary feeling, yeah. Like they were under attack.
Right. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that the current occupant of the White House fueled his political ambitions by this birtherism of his, which was empirically shown to be false. And people lapped that up.
They continued to embrace that. Do you feel like some of the scenes that we've seen in the past year, for example, Charlottesville, the marches and all of the white supremacy, like coming out from the shadows and being bold and out loud. Do you feel like that is part of a white power structure feeling finally that it's being threatened?
Yes, but let me say that these individuals, these characters and their groups and their collectives have long been present in the United States. So certainly with the ascendance of Donald John Trump, these individuals have been given voice in a way that they hadn't before. And it's become increasingly, I guess in their mind, socially acceptable for them to articulate this kind of race-based hate. However, the dominant ideology in the United States is still one of colorblindness, this idea of post-raciality that race no longer matters. And so it's important that we stay focused on the fact that despite the resurgence of these race-based hate groups, that these are individuals are not the principal reason that folks of color have lower life chances relative to whites.
Not because of the guys with the tiki torches.
Right. Now, they are actively recruiting, you know, as Dr. May mentioned, on campuses, and national news has shown they've been posting flyers throughout the country. And so some whites that perhaps weren't a part of that could become sympathetic to that. But the dominant ideology is one of colorblindness, that race no longer matters. And that's the thing that fuels the continued white racism that we see in the U.S. today.
Do you think that – is that because it's easy to ignore the institutionalized racism when you say that I'm okay because I don't believe that way?
Yeah, people don't see – it's hard to see white racism manifested, the institutional racism, because it resides in structures.
Is it harder for white people to see it?
Oh, I certainly don't think that they – many of them don't see it. Some see it. Some whites are anti-racist themselves, and they're aware of the racial reality.
So what kind of things in your course are you going to be teaching? Are you going to be teaching about the specific power structures that do exist and for what reasons they do?
Certainly. There'll be a brief overview of the history of white racial domination in terms of the laws that were enacted, the policies that were developed, and the ideologies that were promoted over the last couple hundred years or several hundred years. But we'll move quickly into the social institutions and the way in which white racism manifests itself, for example, in education, the labor market, the economy, the criminal justice system, as well as others, the media.
Do you know yet if your course is already populated, if people already applied to be part of that course?
Yeah, I'm pleased to say that it's been very well received despite the controversy that arose around it. It was capped at 35 initially, and that quickly filled and, of course, was increased to 40. And today it's now at 50.
So you're going to have 50 students that are interested
in
this.
Probably the room seats 57. I anticipate that all the seats will be filled.
Do you know who might be filling those seats? Do you anticipate seeing a lot of white faces in the crowd?
I think I'll see. There some white students take the class.
And that brings me to a point that sometimes comes up whenever we have panels that are discussing race and we have panels that are talking about the things of this nature. They tend to be populated by a few white faces in the crowd, but then the rest is made up by other races. So I wanted to ask, how is it, Jay Webb, how do you get more faces at the table?
Well, I think it's critical that both young black and young white students understand that the civil rights movement was not only fought with just black people. I mean, if you look at the whites who were involved in the civil rights movement, Viola Yusup, a white woman from Detroit, Michigan, was killed doing what? Helping blacks register to vote. Many, many Jewish rabbis rode buses and white people rode buses into Birmingham. So my thing is that you have to establish the fact that who you are, whether you're black or white. If you're white, no one says it's wrong to be white. It is if you still harbor the feelings of people in the 1800s or people that wanted to lynch or didn't want to give women's rights or Native Americans' rights. If those are your feelings in 2017, then you got an issue and you have a problem. But this is a people issue. If we as people don't come together and have discussions, this country is going to go to hell in a handbasket, and that's what we want to avoid. And I think people like Dr. Thornhill and Dr. May are having discussions so that young kids understand that this, there needs to be a collaborative effort of people to have these discussions. And I think we're going to see a good representation of students, both white and black, at this discussion on Thursday, and we hope we do.
It's an interesting time also, this time in students' lives. There are a lot of people that, going to a college campus is probably the first time they will interact with the people of different races, especially people coming from smaller towns, maybe more rural areas that may have different, a set of values that had been taught to them from where they came from. And now here they are and maybe not understand how to deal with people from other races. And I wanted to ask Dr. May, do you see sociologically this being a critical time in a person's life in these formative years in the late teens, early 20s?
Absolutely. And I think one of the challenges is that precisely as you said, like you grew up in a small town, you grew up with maybe very homogeneous populations, you know, everybody goes to the same church, everybody's the same race, everybody has the same political beliefs. And, a lot of our students are, developing their own identity. And I think one of the reasons why we don't see many why we don't see many whites at these events is because a lot of white people don't think that race applies to them. Just as, you know, when you talk about gender, it's mostly women. And so a lot of men don't think that they have a gender, that we have a gender. And so – and I think it's important in college to sort of expose yourself with various ideas to also, you know, sort of dispel some of the myths. You know, there's this is for a variety of reasons, right? And so variety of identities, and that there is – you know, that things that might seem odd or weird are not that different from things that we do ourselves.
We are talking about race, immigration, and white supremacy in the post-Obama era, and you can join the conversation at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Now, Dr. Thornhill, you are there in front of the students all the time. You're meeting all these young people, and what you're going to be teaching with the white supremacy course, it could be really shocking to people of color that are in your class, that are some of the minority students that you'll be teaching. They may not know why these structures exist or where they came from or how they originated. How do you anticipate that some of these students might respond to learning that?
I think it's liberating for many students of color who are not aware of this history that we have or the way society currently works. It's kind of freeing. I think that many students of color that first learn about this, I would say that growing up as a person of color, you would have various experiences, but it's often difficult to put it into a broader framework without some assistance to understand how all these pieces fit together. And so by teaching these types of courses and having students take these types of courses, students of color are able to make sense of the world they live in. I've had many students come to a point of realization. We're like, yeah, that's how that works. I always wondered what the term for that was.
Or why is this? Why do people feel this way about this group of people? I've wondered that about a lot of things. I mean, why do people have this historical issue with this particular group? I don't understand where it came from. And does learning where it came from help maybe some of the students of color understand maybe where it came from, but then also maybe help some of the white students understand, well, maybe this is what I've been taught and now I know where that came from. Do you think knowing that could help them then turn it around?
Well, Julie, think about this. The movie Hidden Figures was a glowing example. I mean, I'm 70 years old. So why didn't I learn when I was 18 in high school that we had black women and white women helping NASA? So I'm at 70, they have a movie that tells me about something that I was living in that time period. So for many young blacks and for many young whites, they're looking at this going like, wait a minute, because right now the big thing is STEM. Well, we could have maybe kicked STEM off 50 years ago if we'd have known that those black women and those white women were crunching those numbers. So from that standpoint, I think what Ted talks about, because institutional racism and sexism, where discrimination against women have been sort of joined at the hip, haven't they, from that standpoint. So when you have those blinders come off, whether you're white or black, you're like, wow, this actually happened. And that movie was a reality for young black students and young white students in this country because most people have seen that movie. And it was blatant racism and blatant sexism.
Well, and then also the history being taught in such a way that just completely left it out, like you say. And do you think, Dr. May, maybe going into this in this information era, do you think it's possible that we're getting to a point where it's impossible to hide these inspirational figures from the past? Do you think we're getting to a point where we're going to be so aware of all the different races and everything, where everything came from? Now, everything's at your fingertips. It takes nothing to Google search things and to start getting an understanding. Is it possible with that level of information, as a sociologist, do you see society ever getting post-racial?
I think the goal to start with that last comment, I think the goal should be post-racist. I don't think we want to aspire to not see race. I mean, you know, if you look around you, we see race. The problem is when we start saying that, you know, you're that group, so you're inferior. So I think the goal should be post-racist. now to your bigger point, I think it has pros and cons. And I think because information is at our fingertips, that we're sort of overwhelmed with information. And it's a very important to, you know, develop critical thinking skills, critical, you know, media literacy skills to, like, how do you assess, you know, what information to be trusted? And we see quite a lot of, you know, contemporary discussions, you know, whether it's about the Confederate statues, whether it's about the Confederate flag, whether it's about, you know, other sort of topics regarding race, you know, you can easily find information that backs up what you believe.
Any point of view, yeah.
Whereas, you know, it's important to be able to figure out, is this reliable, is this trustworthy? So I definitely think that those inspirational stories, yes, there's definitely a platform for it. But it's important to also know how to find this information and how to critically assess it.
Well, there's all the information out there, but when it's coming at you from a given angle, yeah, then that's when it's hard to take it at face value, which makes me want to turn again to you, Dr. Thornhill. What were you going to say?
I was going to mention, too, about your question about why students don't know this material already. I think that they're secondary school education in many ways, particularly their social studies that they learn, is deficient and problematic. And
I've who wrote the history book?
Right. And it goes beyond that, but who writes it? I've done some research in this area, and I've published in this area, particularly with the African American experience and how their familial racial socialization is connected to their experience learning about African American history or a lack thereof in their high school U.S. history courses. And often students will mentioned that the material might have been in the textbook, but the teachers never got to it, or they had to prepare them for standardized tests, so they didn't make it there, or they give a kind of short shrift to the material. Often they'll think that King is hyper-elevated and turned into somebody that he wasn't. And so if they know anybody, they know about King. And so, you know, even conservatives, you know, will mention that they love King now. Back then, it wasn't so much. But people have co-opted King to proselytize a rendering of our society that's inconsistent with reality. King didn't argue that his dream had been realized. He didn't say that it would be realized in 20 years or 15 years. But some people have taken that out of context and now claim that we have this kind of post-racial society, which is very dangerous.
Well, there's two things there, Ted. And, you know, there's a poem written by Oliver Wendell Hines called Dead Men Make Convenient Heroes, mm-hmm. that we sing, we praise them and talk about them, but what do we actually do? And 2 years ago, with our lecture series, we brought in Dr. Joe White, and Dr. Joe White was the first black psychologist in America, got his degree in Michigan State in 1959, and started the Black Psychological Association, where they had to do battle because white psychologists were telling Congress, number one, the Tuskegee Airmen should not be allowed to fly when the 142nd never lost a bombardier going into Germany. Now, we had Tuskegee Airmen that died. Blacks couldn't be quarterbacks because they didn't have the cognitive thought process to analyze, you know, the defenses. Warren Moon, who was the best player in the Pac-8, MVP of the Rose Bowl, had to go to Canada and spend 10 years there before he came in the NFL. So Joe fought that battle, integrated. And the culmination of that fight that started almost 50 years ago is now a black woman is president of the American Psychological Society, who was a mentor of Joe White. And Joe came and spoke to our psychology department and to our students. We had about 400 or 500 people there to hear him speak. So those are the kind of things that were going against people learning and being taught a bunch of garbage. From that standpoint,
it sounds like you have a series of very interesting panel discussions.
Well, you know, we've been, you know, our partnership with WGCU, we did the whole thing on desegregation in Southwest Florida. Mm-hmm. We worked with Barbara Lindstrom and had that discussion 2 or 3 years ago. And we just try to bring in topics that are sometimes controversial, but are relevant to this campus and relevant to the Southwest Florida community.
This is really going to be a good panel this week. When is it again?
It is Thursday night. We're blessed to have these two very bright gentlemen. I'm just along as you know, they tell me I have a face for radio, so I'm living up to that dream.
I'm sitting here feeling like I need to start studying.
But with Dr. Mary DeWeese, who's in our department, very bright professor who will bring I think it's just a really sound way to moderate this thing. And then Issa Pinero brings a Latino perspective, and Ashton Hartley, who is a person of color, can talk about how this whole – all these issues affect students that are here in FGCU and in the basic students in Southwest Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm excited about having these four people be what I think is going to be an outstanding panel. Ted was with us when we did a panel on the other Wes Moore a couple years ago and had just a invigorating discussion with students and people in Southwest Florida.
So this will be Thursday. What time?
5:30 starts the reception. We're going to have actually – so for students out there, I'm stepping up. We're going to have free pizza.
What?
Yes.
Now free pizza.
It's yeah. We're going to have enough pizza to feed, I think, the 142nd Airborne Division. So.
Oh, okay. Great. So there's enough seating then for everybody.
Yeah. We've got seating for about 300 people, and I'm hoping I got to go get more chairs.
All right. Great. Well, that'll – and do people have to pre-register or they just show up?
Show up.
Go
in
center.
Email Ted Thornhill, Jan May, Issa Pinero, and Ashton Hartley. They're going to be there. I'll give you their email addresses later on.
All right, great. Yeah, email. How about personal cell phones?
That'd personal cell phones.
All right. Well, I want to thank you guys all for coming in and talking with me about this upcoming panel, and of course with your show. With your course coming up this spring. Dr. Ted Thornhill, thanks so much for coming in and talking.
Thank you for having me.
Also, I want to thank Dr. Jan May. Thanks for talking with us about the sociology aspect of all of this.
Thanks for having us.
And Jay Webb Horton, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Julie. Thanks for having us.
Coming up, a program aimed at teaching entrepreneurial skills to veterans has found a home here at FGCU, and now that it's finished its first session, we'll hear from one of the success stories. That's coming up next.